Welcome to the 8 p.m. Saturday night speakers meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Terrence and I'm an alcoholic. Will you join me in a moment of silence followed by a serenity prayer? Serenity prayer.
God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad you're here, especially newcomers. In keeping with the singleness of purpose and the old tradition which states, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. We ask that all who participate confine their discussion to problems that, as they relate to alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversies, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help others to achieve sobriety. In accordance with group conscience, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off, put it on vibrate, leave it in the car. If you brought kids, do the same thing to them. I've asked Cole to read how it works.
Thanks, Clarence.
My name's Cole and I'm an alcoholic. This is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave and emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
I'm Tom, but I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 commissions. One, our common welfare should come first. First, recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants that do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Thus, problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, and we remind us to place principles before personality.
I'm Baldwin Alcoholic. We're painstaking at this phase of our development. We'll be amazed before we're halfway. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past and wish to shut the door on. We will comprehend the word serenity. We will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away, our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. For these extravagant promises with those young, they're being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, they will always materialize to work with it.
There we go. Anybody else?
Who are you?
No, that's my mom.
I don't know. 10 months. Oh, I don't know. There's 11. 11. 8. 9. 9. 7. I don't see the 10 months. Sorry. Anybody else?
300 times 6 months.
Oh, I got that kid. Probably the other day, next Saturday night, he brings him up.
When I signed up to do these Saturday night speakers meetings, I looked around and tried to get speakers from the outside. I heard of James, our speaker tonight, through the Meridian Group. James is one of the speakers at the third anniversary of the Meridian Group. Tonight it's my pleasure to introduce James from Waco.
My name is James Matthews and I'm an alcoholic. There's somewhere between now and the time I get through, I get down there real low and you can't hear me, you're probably not missing nothing. But if it bothers you, you can just pull your chair up front and that won't bother me. I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink since May the 1st of 1984. And I'm grateful for that. Sometimes I forget to be grateful for that, but, you know, today I'm grateful. I really am. I fall off into this thing every once in a while where I forget to think about other people, or I get more involved in me and what's going on in my life and what I'm getting and what I'm not getting. And usually it's the what I'm not getting, and I forget to be grateful. You know, I came to program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out of jail about 4 hours, five, something like that. And the reason that I came is hell, I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know. I got out of jail that morning off the DWI that I didn't intend to get, just like the one before that that I didn't intend to get.
Yeah.
I came home to a wife that I didn't know whether she was going to let me back in the house after the way that I conducted myself the evening before or not. You know, whenever I left to go finish out my drinking career, or at least I think I was finishing it out, I was about two steps ahead of the cop that my son had called because I was terrorizing him and his mother. And, you know, I didn't intend to do that. That's just the way it worked out. I came home from jail that morning. I sat down on the couch and I assumed a position that was kind of familiar because I'd been doing it for a lot of years. I'm sitting there on the couch and I've got my elbows on my knees. I'm almost holding my head in my hands. And, where in the past I had told her that I was sorry for what I had done, that I didn't know why I had done it, and if she'd just give me one more chance, I wouldn't do it again. You know, she just kept giving me chance after chance after chance. And you know, the one thing that was constant in all that was that she would give me another chance and I'd screw it up. You know, I always go back there and do it. And that morning, the thing that was different was that I sat there and instead of saying, you know, I don't know why I did what I did, I'm sorry and I won't do it again, I told her that I had a problem, that I needed help, and that she couldn't help me. You know, and her response, I wasn't really ready for it. She said, well, I'm going to go and meet with some people at noon, and I'm going to get some help for me. And I asked her if I could go. And she said yes. And she followed it up with something that I'm going to remember, and then I'm going to share it with you, too. You know, she said, but whether you go or not, I'm going. You know? I don't know if you've ever experienced that being alone, but that, you know, she was all that I had left. You know, I got no other place to go. I got nobody else to turn to. and she's given me that choice. And it's a decision that I've got to make. You know, I'm going to go and get help. If you want to go, you can, but whether you go or not, I'm going. And I went in there and washed the old jailhouse smell off of me, put on some clean clothes. And at noon on the 1st of May 1984, I walked into my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whenever she said that she was going to go get help, I didn't ask her what she was going to do. I didn't ask her where she was going to go or anything else. I just asked if I could go with her. I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous in a roundabout way whenever I was about 15 years old. I was working as a short order cook in a little cafe, and this cat came stopping in one day, and he's wearing white shirt, white pants, white shoes. He's got the sparkle in his eye and his bounce, you know. And after we worked together for 2 or 3 days, he figured out that I had a drinking problem. And he handed me this little card. And it's just a single phone card. And on one side it's got 12 steps, and on the other side it's got 12 traditions. It's got the Serenity Prayer and the preamble on it. And I read it, and I handed it back to him. I told him, that's nice. You know? And he was fresh out of the VA hospital. You know, he had that thing that y'all had given him, and he was ready to give it away. And it took me every bit of 2 weeks, and I had his ass out there with me, running, jumping, and playing. And we did that for a lot of years, you know. The last time that I remember seeing him, I was sitting on my parents' front porch. I was still drinking because I didn't run out the night before. And this is early in the morning, and he comes walking up the street, and I asked him if he wanted a beer, and he said, not today. You know, and I didn't say it, but I thought, good, I'll drink that one too. And he went his way and I went mine. And I didn't see him again for several years. The first meeting that I made in Alcoholics Anonymous after, in my hometown, of course, Corsicana, after that first meeting there in Waco, I walked in the front door, and as I was walking in the front door, he was coming out of the kitchen. And he was fixing to celebrate 5 years sober. And that morning, while I was sitting there on the front porch offering him beer and being grateful that he didn't take it, you know, he was starting that journey, if you will, back to where we're at today. And, but you know, I didn't know that. I really didn't care. You know, I'll just go ahead and keep on drinking and do what I got to do. I never intended to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we had a standing joke whenever I was a kid. They talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we said, yeah, that's where you go and drink. You just don't tell nobody who you are. We still got people in here that think that's what that is. You know, I did what any normal kid does. You know, I would sit around, and whenever my father drank a beer, he would give me a little taste, and I liked it. You know, hear a lot of people say they can't stand the taste of beer. I love the taste of beer. I always have and I always will. Ain't got no reason to quit loving the taste now. Just can't taste it. You know? I sat there and I would take a swallow with my daddy. You know, I remember vaguely the first time that he gave me a full can of my own. And my old head got all buzzed up and funny, and you know, it might scare somebody, but it didn't scare me. I like that. I really did. I'm the youngest kid out of five. I've got two brothers and two sisters, you know, and they don't do the kind of stuff that I did, or at least I didn't think they did. I've got a brother that's just older than me, and today, you know, he's got a daughter that's, got, I don't know, 30, no, 20-something, almost 30 years old, and whenever she was born, he stopped drinking, you know. Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that every once in a while we find a reason, you know, it's sufficient, and that was his, the birth of his daughter, and he don't need to drink no more. I've got an older sister who has a drink or two, and by the time she finishes that second one, she starts feeling funny, and she doesn't like that feeling, so she doesn't drink a third one. I don't understand that. I like that feeling. I want to see what that's like before for I've got another brother who is not an alcoholic, and he'll tell you that he's not an alcoholic, and to prove it to you, he'll stay sober for a full year. And on the 366th day, he goes and does what we do. you know, but he's not a drink, you know, he's not an alcoholic, he doesn't ever buy. And then my oldest sister, and I love her, and I told her, I said, you know, I remember whenever I was a kid that you used to drink. And she said, yes, I did. And I said, why don't you drink no more? And her words were, whenever I drank, I did crazy shit. And I didn't want to do that no more. So she quit, you know. And I enjoyed it from the beginning, just almost right up until the very end. And this is what I do. You know, I said, why did I turn out the way I did and yelled it? And their response was, we did everything that you did. We just quit doing it before you got old enough to remember. You know? And that was fine. I've got a normal family. You know, that's just a normal family to me. I did what every kid does, you know, right up until the point that I started drinking. And from the time that I actually started drinking, I drank alcoholically. I drank everything that I can for as long as I can until I can't. You know, whether I physically can't drink, whether there's nothing left to drink, and then I don't. You know. And on occasion, you know, I go out and have one or two drinks and I stop. That's all I want. But most of the time, that's not the case, you know. I just drink all of there is, mine, yours, and whatever we can go and get. I also had a little attitude change, you know. Up until the time I was 12 years old, you know, whatever those people wanted me to do, whether it was my parents, my teachers, you know, just older people in general, you know, that was what I did. And once I started to drink, that attitude changed, and what it was now it's whatever James wants. Whatever James wants, it doesn't make any difference what I've got to do to get it. You know, that's the deal now. And, you know, it doesn't work real good in school. Teachers expect stuff of you. And they don't really care whether you want to do it or not. They want you to do it. And when you don't, they throw you out. And I started this little pattern. You know, they would throw me out and tell me that if I wanted to come back, I'd have to bring one of my parents with me. So I'd go home and tell my parents that I was sorry that for what I'd done and I wouldn't do it no more. And they would take that lie and they'd go back to whoever I was, you know, pleasing this time, and they would tell that same lie to them. And that person would say, okay, we'll do this again. And they'd do it, and I would stay straight for a little while, and then, you know, somewhere along the line, they wanted me to do something that I didn't want to do, and I'd go back to doing what I wanted. And they'd throw me out, and I'd have to go back and tell my mother the same lie, and she'd go tell the principal the same lie. And he'd say, okay, we'll try this again. We did it for about 3 years. I finally just got to the point where I got tired of lying. I didn't really get tired of lying. I just got tired of doing that same old stuff over and over, and I quit because I've become real intelligent now. Worked that summer in a Sonic drive-in. I was making 50 cents an hour, and I could meet my own needs. 50 cents an hour, you can buy all the cigarettes and beer, and you can smoke and drink. And so I quit school. And my father told me that if I wasn't going to go to school, I had to have a job. And I said, that's not a problem. I worked at Sonic. And I went back to Sonic, and I found out that if you're going to try and buy some clothes and buy some food to go along with the beer and cigarettes, you've got to find a way to supplement your income. So I became a thief. Yeah, and I did that for a while until I got caught. I thought that I had this illustrious criminal career, and I had to think about it, looking at it, you know, realistically. You know, I was just a damn little old thief, and I wasn't all that good at it. Got caught, and they put me in jail, put me on probation. And I'm sitting there in jail, and they brought some of these old cons back up from Huntsville on bench warrants, and they got to tell them some of them horror stories. You know, they're just laughing about it, and they got to tell them about the funny things that happened to pretty little boys down there, and I thought, I don't need no part of that. And that was the end of my criminal career. You know, short-lived, but, yeah, uneventful, too. But I got this probation officer. They weren't going to send me to the penitentiary. They got this probation officer, and I dealt with him for a while, and somewhere between the time I got him and whenever she appeared. And I was sitting at that same Sonic drive-in, and this little girl got out of the car somewhere back off over there. Did you ever remember hot pants were really popular?
Yes.
Those were the hottest hot pants I ever seen in my life. And you know, to borrow a line out of the big book, it says, if you want what we have and willing to have any way to get it. And I did. I married her. Yeah. And that probation officer would get pissed off at me because I wasn't doing what he wanted me to do and expected me to do, and I would go down there and I would tell him the lie that he wanted to hear. I won't do this anymore. I'll do what you want me to do. And he'd say, okay. Then I got to where I was working out of town, and whenever he got pissed off at me, I would tell her that lie. She'd tell that lie to him, and he'd say, okay, and you know, we'd go on. And then he gets upset with me, and he threatened to send me to the penitentiary. And, you know, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. I mean, I'm big, but I can cry on demand. Then you cry to him a little bit, and you tell him, you know, I'm sorry, I won't do this anymore. Please don't send me to jail. And he says, okay, you know, and we did that. You can get off probation whenever you've served about, what, half to two-thirds of your time? I did every day of it. Every single day. You know, I mean, I'm a success. I could have waited something. And you know, the day that I got off, we're saying our goodbyes, and he said, I'll see you later. And I said, no, you really, by God, won't. And he said, yeah, James, people like you always come back. And within a year, I was back in there, and this time it was for DWI. You know, the man didn't even bother telling me not to drink, even though it's, you know, it's for alcohol-related. We'd had one of those conversations one day while I was paying a visit. And he asked me, he says, you were arrested here. What was up with that? And I said, well, me and Roy was out riding around the lake making some beer. And he said, well, this time that you got arrested over here, what was up with that? I said, well, me and Clarence was out in the country right now drinking some beer. And we did that three or four times. And he said, does that suggest anything to you, James? And I said, yeah, I got caught a lot. Yeah. Another part of our conversation was, you know, have you ever considered not drinking? And I told him, and I was serious, I wasn't being smart, Ellie. I said, you know, I have drank so much for so long. And at the time, I was probably 23, 24 years old. I said, I've drank so much for so long that to stop would be like cutting off my arm. It's just a part of it. It's part of what I do. And he just shook his head. Yeah. He suggested that there were some people that might be able to help me. And I assured him that if I ever got that bad, I would quit. Yeah. I just wouldn't. I didn't know. You know, we make all kinds of promises to ourselves, and we got all these thoughts running through my head that, you know, I'll be able to, and I never was. But I, she and I, oh, what's her name? We had this deal. We would fight. And somewhere in there, whenever we got married, we got a kid. Actually, we had the kid, then we got married. And we started using him kind of like a chess piece. You know, more like a pawn on a chessboard. And the thing was that if I could get him between me and you, and I had the door behind me, you were stuck with the kid. And you know, she was a willing participant in that, because there were times whenever that kid was between me and her, and she had the door behind her. And we had those times whenever we stayed together for a little while, and then we'd had times whenever we stayed together for a short while. And you know, one of us was just always leaving. And we got to a point in that relationship where she had enjoyed about all of me that she could stand. And she told me that she wanted a divorce, and I said, okay. And she was going to relocate. She was moving from Corsicana over to Waco, and because we've got this kid and we're going to stay friends and so forth, I'm going to help her move. And we got all this stuff loaded up, and we went over to Waco. And we got over there, and we got everything unloaded and set in place, and we're sitting there and we're talking, and she said, you know, this is nice. I said, it really is. She said, why don't you stay? And I said, all right. You know? And we started that deal again. And, you know, the thing that was different, this is a period of peace, you know, tranquility. For about 6-7 months, things were good. You know, the kid was going to school, she had a little job, and I'm doing my job. And the thing that's different is I'm not drinking. Yeah. And everything was all right. And Christmas came, and there's the Christmas party, and they're going to pass out bonus checks and so forth. This captain I'm working with, he says, come on. We'll go down here, and after they get through with all their speeches, we'll come back and get our checks. All right? So we left, and we stopped at the store. He says, you want a beer? And I said, you know what? I don't drink. I'll just get a Coke. So we rode around for a little while. He says, you sure you don't want a beer? One beer won't hurt. And you know he was right. One beer don't hurt. So I drank a six pack. Then I got home that night, and you know, her first words were, "You've been drinking." I said, "Yeah, but we're not fighting. It's going to be okay." And she agreed, you know. And we started one of those deals. And we did that for another 4 years, you know. And the difference this time was, didn't need one of us leave. We just stayed and fought it out, you know. I introduced her to, what is that word, domestic violence, you know. Something's on the other side of that door that I want, and you're in my way, you're going to move, either under your own volition or I'll move you, you know. And she's fairly a decent sized woman. I mean, she's ever been a 5 foot tall and about 95 pounds, you know. And I asked her to move nicely, and she wouldn't move, so I slapped hell out of her, and she moved. And I walked out the door, and it took every bit of 3 or 4 beers before I stopped feeling guilty about slapping her. And the next time that I was wanting to go out that door, and she was between me and the door, and she wouldn't move, you know, I slapped her faster, and it didn't take but 2 beers, you know. And that's the kind of crazy shit that we got to, excuse me. You know, that's the kind of craziness. And you know, and I put nothing off on her, but, you know, if you think this girl ain't two-sided, you know, you got to be crazy to stay in it. But we do. You know, it doesn't make any difference whether it's somebody big like me slapping her or somebody small like her slapping me. You know, it's just crazy. But, you know, if we don't know that there's something else, what do we got to go to? There's a ladies' meditation book, and it's not conference approved, but the name of it is Each Day a New Beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Green Book.
Mm-hmm.
Read September the 13th. It talks about why we stay in the conditions that we stay in, why we go through, put ourselves through, and allow ourselves to be put through the stuff that we do. And it's because we don't know what's on the other side of that door, you know? And it's better to stay in the known, as bad as it is, than to face the unknown and you know, not find out that it's better. You know? Fear. Plain and simple. But that's, you know, that's the way we live. Whenever we got here, you know, we'd gotten down to that point. I had drank to the point that, you know, I know I've got a problem. I'm having trouble, you know. In the past, I'm a periodic drunk, and whenever the time comes, you know, I'll stop for whatever period of time it takes to get them off my back. And now I'm trying to stop, and I can't. And I finally sat down, and I had a meeting with her and my partner, and we talked about it, and they came up with a plan, a solution. The book says there is a solution. This is theirs. He's going to watch me during the day while we're working, and I can't drink while he's watching me. And then at night, whenever I come home, she'll be watching me, and I can't drink at night while she's watching me. Now, that's a solution. But if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, and you decide to drink, it doesn't make any difference what they think. You know, it's not going to work. I don't know when I started drinking again. I don't see how they couldn't have seen. It's not, you know, it's not their fault. It's not their responsibility. I'm the one that made the decision. I'm the one that drank. You know, but I mean, it's got to be apparent. And maybe somewhere along the line, people just get to that point where they say, "What's the use?" You know, I woke up in my vehicle one morning, and there's some cat asking me if I'm okay. He's shining a light in my eyes, and it's this cop. He says, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know where you're at?" I said, "No, if you give me a few minutes, I'll tell you." And it took me a few minutes to get my head clear enough to figure out that I was sitting in my van with the engine running in front of my house. I had no idea how I got there. It scared the hell out of me. That was whenever I asked for that first little intervention, you know. And whenever they said that they were going to help me by watching me, you know, I think that I made it about a week. That's all. About a week. And I just right back into it. I remember the day before I went out on that last drug, I went walking my job looking for an excuse. You know, if you look hard enough, you can find just the right excuse to do what you want to do, or at least I can. And, you know, I found it, and I did it. I went back, and I went home. I was looking for something. I don't know what. I didn't actually go home to Corsica. I went home back over to my head, the old beer joints I used to drink in. And I made the rounds in there. And as I made the rounds, you know, I heard about first this person died, you know, my old favorite bartender. And then that one died, another old drunk that I drank with for a long time. And then they told me about this kid. His name is Johnny. Me and Johnny, we kind of met up in junior high. And we pulled our first really good drunk together. We gave his mother like $6. And she went and got 2 12-year-old boys a case of beer. She got her a six pack. We sat out behind the house. No, don't say, oh, this is good. We sat out behind the house and we drank that case of beer. We got drunk, we puked, and we passed out. And whenever I woke up the next morning, I wanted to do it again. And Johnny and I, we kind of split up and we sort of bounced back together. And whenever I met him, he's doing a little bit of drugs. I'm drinking a little bit. And we're gonna get together and we're gonna spend some time together. And we never did, you know. Drinking's more important, drugging's more important, whatever. And I'm over in my head that day and somebody said, "Did you hear about it?" I said, "No." It seemed my buddy had gone out and he stuck a gun in his mouth and pulled a trigger, you know. And for the longest time, I said, you know, it's kind of like part of me died. You know, it just hurt. And I can't tell you that I hurt because at the time, I really didn't know how in hell I felt. It was just different. And I went home. I want to talk to somebody about this, but I don't have really anybody to talk to except her. And I walk in the door to tell her how I'm feeling. I'm trying to tell her, and all that I can hear from her is, "You son of a bitch, you're drunk again." You know, and she was right. And that was whenever I started that last little deal. You know, I didn't hit her, but I tore the house up. You know, made an ass out of myself. She sent the kid to call the cops, and I love this. If you're on one side of the street in Waco, and the cop's on the other side, he's where he's supposed to be, and he can't do nothing to you. You know, something about jurisdiction. And she's sitting there telling that cop, "What do you mean you can't arrest him? Hell, he's just right there." And they said, "You don't understand. He's on the wrong side of the street." And you know, that, it's kind of like lining up all those planets. Everything's got to be just right for that last drink. Then I borrowed a car and I went home. And home is where it's safe. You know, I can go home and it'll be okay. My friends are there, my family's there, and my friends and family always make it good. And I made it a little hour drive to Corsicana, and I'm looking for refuge. It never occurred to me, you know, my parents are dead. They've been dead for several years. The friends that I'm going to go to, you know, the ones that would really help me, they're gone. They died. Or they're locked up down there somewhere. You know, they did the kind of stuff that alcoholics do, and they met the end that alcoholics meet, you know. Some of them run into each other head on the highway out there and killed each other. You know, some of them knew who they was killing, some of them didn't. But a couple of them got wise and got in a boat in the middle of winter and rode out into the middle of Cigarette Creek Lake, froze to death, and a little bit drunk. You know, that's what I was going home to. This is my refuge. You know, those guys that I really never really cared about, they did something strange. They grew up, you know. They grew out of all that stuff. They went and they got families, they got jobs, careers, homes, and you know, they became responsible. And I just kept on doing what I wanted to do because that's what I wanted to do, you know. But that was what I was going back to. And, you know, that was where I was at whenever that cop got me that last time. You know, just something as simple as turning a corner and rubbing a tire against the median and the cop thinks, huh. You know, let's look a little bit further. And I ended up in jail again. And you know the difference that night. I've been in jail a bunch of times, and if any of y'all have, you know, the first thought that runs through my mind whenever those lights flash is, am I going to go to jail? If I go to jail, who's going to come get me? What's it going to cost? How long am I going to be in there? You know, stuff like that. And that night, you know, those thoughts weren't there. You know, I thought, okay, you know, that's enough. If you've ever had somebody whooping your ass so bad that you just want them to quit, you know, that's kind of where I was whenever you hit those lights. I just don't want to fight no more. You know, this is enough. they took me to jail and booked me in, and you know, I'm sitting there in the jail cell, and I go to sleep. There ain't nothing else you can do. And I wake up the next morning, and I wake up with this thought. You know, it's not going to get any better. And I can't tell you how I knew that. I just knew that it wasn't. It may get worse, but it's not going to get any better. The night before, while I'm out enjoying myself so much, that woman is on the phone. And she had talked to a lady in this other program we have around here called Almon. Lady had given her some literature. Where she had sang this song of woe to her about this drunk husband that she's got that doesn't come home and so forth. This lady left the job, drove all the way home on her lunch hour, got this material, literature, brought it back to her and said, "Read this." And a couple of days later, she asked her, "Did you get a chance to read that?" She said, "Oh, I didn't have to. He came home." And he said, "He's not going to do that anymore." And the lady said, "You know what? I hope that you're right. But if it happens again, what you need to do is, you need to call somebody in Waco because I'm too far away to be there for you." And that's what she did. She remembered what that woman had said. She found a number in the phone book. She called. She got a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. And she got a lady alcoholic. That lady alcoholic did something strange. What she did was, she didn't share a whole lot of feelings and attitudes and opinions. She said, "You know, if you'll go to this address tomorrow at noon, there will be people there that can help you." And she stopped. And then they talked a little bit, and she asked the question, "You know, is there any chance that he'll be violent if he comes home?" And my wife said, "Not if I leave him alone." Well, I didn't come home, so we didn't have to find out whether she was right or not. But, you know, that's what she did. She had somebody from Program Battle Line that had reached out, and then whenever she called, there was a woman alcoholic that reached back. And I'll be forever grateful for that lady. Her name's Mary S., and she lives in Waco now. You know, she told her, "You know, I'll be there if you decide to go." And the next day, we met her. And we walked into that room at noon that day, and I looked for the safest place around. And the safest place around was as far away from y'all as I could get. Now, this is a small room. It's probably a fourth the size of this one, old triangle. And there's a spot over on the couch, about where you're sitting. And I've got to get over there. But in order to get over there, I've got to go by this old man. And that old bastard reached up out of his chair, raised up out of his chair, reached his hand out, introduced himself, and he said something to the effect of, "We're glad you're here," or "I'm glad you're here." Doesn't matter. Somebody was glad I was there, and I couldn't understand why. You know, we went around and did the deal that we're doing newcomer meetings, and as people shared that day, you know, they talked about themselves, and they were describing me. You know, they said the same things then that we're continuing to say now. You know, they told us that they understood, they told us that they cared, they invited us to come back. You know, they said something about making 90 meetings in 90 days. And, you know, we decided we'll try and do that too. We left that meeting that day, and before I left, that same old man that had introduced himself gave me his card. "This is my name, this is my phone number, if you need to talk, you know, for whatever reason, just give me a call." And I held on to that card for the longest time. You know, whenever it finally got to a point where I needed to call that old man, I knew his phone number by heart. I knew where he lived. I knew where and when he made meetings. You know, I mean, I knew where he was at. And later he would become my sponsor. She and I left that meeting that day, and we went home and we talked. We didn't talk about what had happened the night before. We didn't talk about what the legal cost was going to be and so forth for AWI. We didn't talk about what I'd done to her and the boy. What we talked about was what y'all had shared with us that day in that meeting, you know? And we really believed what you said. Why in the hell, you know, two strangers believe a room full of strangers? You know, but we did. Yeah, something special about you. It really is. And we decided that we would try and make that commitment to make, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. She didn't know it didn't apply to her, but what the hell, she needed help anyway. That was on a Tuesday, and on Wednesday we went back, and whenever we went back, they had two closed meetings. One of them was Al-Anon, one of them was AA, and we went our separate ways, and that's where it was for the longest time. You know, I'd like to tell you that she and I are still together today, and we're not. You know, there's a point that I came to in my quote sobriety or dryness, which is a whole lot more accurate. And in 3 years, you know, 3 years sober, I'm as sick as the day I was whenever I walked in. You know, I'm not drinking, but I'm just as sick and just as crazy. And 3 years later, I continued to spread that sickness and insanity to the point that one more time she'd enjoy it all me she could stand. And she asked me to leave, and I did. Now, she gave me the best argument for me to leave that morning as I've ever heard. She said, you know what, I don't want to live this way anymore. You know, and the first step was, you got to go. And it wasn't funny that morning. It's not really all that funny now, but I can smile about it. I didn't smile that day. You know, I went off and holed up in a room somewhere, in a little apartment by myself. And I had these friends that would come by, and they'd tell me that they cared about me. They'd tell me they loved me. They'd ask me if I need anything, if I want to go to a meeting, and they'd leave. You know? And that old sponsor showed up one day, and he'd already, you know, he had told me way back when, he said, you know, I won't chase you down. If you want to talk to me, you come find me. You got nothing that I want. And, you know, he came over that day, and before we got started, he said, I want you to understand that I'm breaking my own cardinal rule by being here. And I said, yeah. And then he told me he loved me, he told me he cared about me, asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and he told me he loved me and left. You know? I'm sitting there, I got a hot coffee pot over here, and I got a loaded gun over here, and I ain't so sure what I want to live or not live or whatever. Ain't nobody saying put up the gun. Yeah, you want to go to a meeting? No. You know? I was sitting there, and I'm not making a whole lot of meetings, I'm not spending a whole lot of time with y'all. But I am doing a little bit of reading, and I'm reading an A grapevine. In this particular article, it's one of the little short ones they used to fill up space in there. And there was a guy that was complaining because the people in his home group weren't treating newcomers the way he felt like they should be treated. He felt like they should be treated the same way that he was treated whenever he showed up. Why ain't y'all doing that? You know? And some little something happened, and he thought, why ain't you doing that? Talking to himself. You know? And I got up out of the floor that day, and I washed a little smell off of him. I put my clothes back on, and I came back to y'all. You know, and I've been here since, for better or worse. Because sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. You know, I do a deal that I describe as just good enough. You know, I do things just good enough to get back to that point where things are okay. And then I get complacent or lazy, whichever word you want to use, about the same thing. And I'll do that until it gets so bad that I can't hardly stand me no more, and then I'll start doing it again, you know? And then about the time it gets feeling good again, I quit. Why'd I do that? Because I'm crazy. And you know, you don't have to do it that way. There was another old man in that meeting that first day, his name was Woody. And Woody would describe this journey that he was on by saying that he had climbed on a pink cloud the day that he sobered up, and he hadn't had to come off of it yet. And this was up until the time that he died. Whenever he died, he was sober almost 17 years, you know. And I saw him one time whenever he had that little weak spot. And it was over something that he had absolutely no control over, no power over. You know, but it was something that was really important to him, and that was his kids. And there was nothing he could do, and that pink cloud started to, you know, get just a little bit darker. And then, you know, something happened, and he was right back up on top of it. But he didn't quit doing what he was doing. You know, he kept on day after day after day. And that's what I forget. You know, if I just, Hey, told me a long time ago, he said, you know, if you'll continue doing what you've been doing, it's going to get better. Whatever it is, it's going to get better. All you've got to do is do tomorrow what you did today and yesterday, and life will continue to get better. And it gets to a point where, you know, better is good enough, and I just stop. And then it gets worse. And then I have to go back and start doing what I was doing a month ago or whatever, you know. And it's simple stuff. It's the same thing, you know, that they told me that first day. it gets almost cliche. It's, you know, trust God, clean house, help others. You know, don't drink, go to meetings, read the book. Just a little simple stuff. And I do that right up to that point. And then I quit. I met me another one of hers. You can't live without her unless you're her and then you do to him. Or at least we think we do. Okay, I ain't so sure that we really don't. But anyway, I found one and had to have it. And I went and talked to him about it. And he had some ideas and he shared them with me. And, you know, I'll make a long story short. You know, we dated for about 4 years. We actually took the time to get to know each other. She had a couple of daughters. I have a son. You know, we let those kids get used to the idea of having a different parent around and so forth. And we got married. And that's fixing to be 13 years ago. And I have a relationship with those girls today, you know, that is a culmination of treating them like alcoholics. You know, you can't treat two girls like alcoholics, but you really can, you know. You listen to them whenever they talk to you, and you tell them the truth whenever they ask you a question. That's it. That's what y'all do for me, at least I think it is. You know, if you think that your sponsor's not listening to you, tell him something that you really don't want him to know and then try to double back on him later. You know, and he says, wait a minute, didn't you tell me one time? Damn, he's not supposed to hurt that. You know, but they do. And I love doing that with those girls. You know, I do it with my son. I treat him just like I would anybody else. You know, that boy, for the longest time after I sobered up, I would move fast and he'd move faster. And I couldn't understand why. And then, you know, one day it's kind of like the light bulb goes off. And there were so many times that I moved fast and he didn't know what was coming and I slapped him. I ain't proud of that, but I did. And after I'd been sober for a while, you know, I could move and he didn't flinch. He didn't back away. And a little over, well, almost 2 years ago, he came and he and his wife and they said, you know, we're going to have a baby. All right. That'll make your mother happy. She worried about grandkids. I ain't worried about grandkids. They said, we're going to have a baby. And what we want to know is, if it's a boy, can we name him James? And I said, that's your kid. You name him whatever you want to. You know? And there's part of me that says, you know, you can't treat people like that and then turn around and treat you like this. But they do. And that's a cute little boy. He gets big ears on him, you know? And his father loves him to death. And his mother loves him to death. And now they're going to have something to go with it. You know, they figured out they like this idea of having kids, you know. And you know, I would almost say, you know, I hope that he enjoys raising his as much as I enjoyed raising him. But raising my son was, you know, it was good. I didn't have to mess with him until he was like 13 years old. 13, I gave him to his God, and him and his God done a real good job ever since then. You know, nothing for me except for a little bit of physical health. And that's been good. The girls, I've got, God, I got two grandsons and a granddaughter by one, and the other one's got dogs and a cat, and I think a bird or two or whatever. She just got no desire to have any kids at all. I'm happy for her. I really am. She's doing good for the animals. And, you know, life's good. It really is. I was putting an addition on my son's house for the arrival of this little boy, and I fell off the damn roof. I ain't real prone to doing stuff like that, but I did. I don't think I've fallen off but one roof in all the time that I've been doing construction work, which is like 34 years, and it had to be his, and I had to break my damn leg. And if you want to learn how to depend on other people, fall off the roof and break your leg, you know. You get to ask him to do strange things for you, you know, like help me up out the chair, help me into the tub. Oh, that's embarrassing as hell. But the embarrassing part is having to ask for help. Adair told me a long time ago, you know, I think that I said something to the effect of I have never had to ask anybody for anything. And he said, maybe it's time you learned how. You know? the funny part about this deal is whenever I fell and broke my leg, you know, I didn't have to ask. It was one of those deals where the need was apparent and the people were there. And you know, I've not doubted that I have friends in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've not doubted the sincerity whenever they tell me that they love me. You know, I can hear it in their voice, I can see it in their eyes, and I can feel it whenever we hug. Even somebody's big and ugly as you call it. You know, it's there. And it's good. It really is.
You know,
we made it through this deal, and you know, life's good today. It really is. Whenever I walked into that first meeting, we got started up, and y'all asked the question that was asked tonight. Similar. You know, is everybody here for the first time coming back that has decided to stop drinking? Is anybody new? And I stuck my hand up and I said, my name's James and I've got a drinking problem. Now, if y'all had let me ask a question, all that I would have asked you is, how do I not drink? Because I knew, this is how smart I was that first day. I knew that if I didn't drink, things would be okay. Now, what your answer would have been if I'd asked that question was, don't take that first drink. And that would have answered right there. And I'd have missed everything else. Yeah, I really would have. Because I'd have gone back out there and I'd have kept doing all that stuff that I did before that didn't work. Now, I had friends whenever I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were people that I drank with. Now, if I would actually count on one hand the number of friends as I define a friend today, I wouldn't have to count. You know, there wasn't nobody. There were people that I drank with, there were people that I worked with, and other than, you know, those family members, you know, there wasn't anybody that I really gave a damn about. All I wanted was to know how not to drink. That day that old man came up out of that chair, you know, that was one. That old man that was standing back behind the coffee bar, you know, that was two. And it's just going on and on and on. I meet friends and make friends in strange ways today. And most of the time, I don't see the opportunity as an opportunity whenever it's presented itself. What it is most of the time is an obstacle to me doing what I want to do. But I end up getting stuck with your ass anyway. You know, and somewhere along the line, while I'm stuck with you, something happens and things change. You know, my life changes, your life changes, and nine times out of ten, it's for the better. You know, and all I've got to do is just be me. You know, I've never enjoyed being me until I met y'all. You know, had to be more. Always had to be more. Yeah, I talked about it over at Meridian. I thought about this on the way up here tonight. I had absolutely no idea what I'm going to say once I get up here. Ain't none of my business what I'm going to say once I get up here. You know, I walk in that door, close it behind me, and I ask my God to remind me that all I'm doing up here is sharing with you. I'm not here to entertain you. I'm not here to impress you. I don't give a damn whether you're impressed or not. You know, I really don't. All I'm doing is what y'all asked me to do, and that's to share. You know, my experience, strength, and nothing. I left the house this evening. Before I left the house, I talked to a voice on the phone. The gal's name is Sonia. She was a whole lot of love. She was stampede looking for a place to happen. And usually it's in my direction. And she was going down to the Freeman Center there on Wake Up Night, and she was going to share. And I said, honey, I'm going to share this with you, and it's a guarantee that you won't mess up. Whenever your mind gets to that point where it doesn't know what else to say, say thank you and sit down. Thank you.
We are self-supporting to our own contribution. We're here for the first time, and we ask that you not contribute. Anyone here at this time would like to die here? I'd like to thank our guests tonight. I enjoyed James coming to share. And our announcements are over on the announcements board. You need a sponsor. Our sponsor board's over here. With that, we'll get it closed and use your mind.
Thank you.